his command. It was Sir Gerald Templer. And Templer phoned me and says, I'd like to come in and see what Amsterdam's like. And this was the day it was liberated. Mm-hmm. So I took him into Amsterdam along with the Dutch liaison officer. So when we were driving, coming into Amsterdam, Templer says, take us to your slums. And this Dutch captain was insulted. Mm-hmm. He turned and looked at Templer and he says, sir, we have no slums in Amsterdam. So he says, well, take us to the poorest part of your city then. Mm-hmm. So we went down, it was along one of the canals, and there we visited a hospital to see what the conditions were there. And we found that, there were signs of hunger edema. And they were, some of them were starving. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, there was no, the Swedish Red Cross had given us those vile reports about what was happening in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. People were dead in the streets, and horses were lying in gutters dead, and all this most horrible story. You know where they got that from? I don't know.
Why would they? Yeah, the question would be, why would they do that? Because the Germans certainly wouldn't purport to be doing this, and why would the Red Cross do that?
Well, this was the Swedish Red Cross, and they were in, apparently, the Germans had let them come in and try to do what they could for the starving Dutch. But these reports were absolutely
outlandish.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. So we were pleasantly surprised when we found what the conditions were, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Mind you, there were some pretty tight belts around there because their ration was a liter of potatoes and 800 grams of black bread. And that was their weekly ration.
No meat?
Nothing, no meat. That was all they got from the Germans.
Yeah. So they had to provide the rest
of it they had to scrounge.
Yeah. How did you find the Dutch people? Because a lot of English people I speak with find them to be very cold, austere people.
I didn't find them like that, but I found them to be very avaricious, mm-hmm. very greedy. Mm-hmm. And I saw several instances where there were fights over when we were distributing things, there'd be fights. I saw fights at some of these grocery stores, mm-hmm. where some person got something more than some person thought that somebody else had more. He had received more than he got.
Yeah. Understandable, but still.
Oh yes. There's another instance. We had what we had a thing called Exercise Eclipse, mm-hmm. and we took all the bicycles we could get. And we ordered the bicycles to be brought to this place at Zeist, and we stockpiled these bicycles in a big field. Mm-hmm. And we put a team of Remy people on these, and with Dutch help. Mm-hmm. And we had parts so that we could assemble bicycles and issue them to the essential services like doctors. No, there were no cars there. There's no gas. So the bicycles are the only thing. And we issued these bicycles to doctors and nurses and social workers and people who we felt that required them. Mm-hmm. I was driving down in Delft along a street. Mm-hmm. And as I came up, there was a fellow chasing another fellow on a bicycle. This fellow had a bicycle, this other fellow was after him, waving his arms and chasing him. So I said to my liaison officer, stop here and let's see what's happening. Mm-hmm. So he asked him what was going on. Well, the fellow who had the bicycle had been issued it. He was a doctor and he had his doctor's bag hanging on the...
On the rat trapper?
Yeah, on the... And this other fellow had recognized his bicycle. So...
He was running after
he wanted his own bicycle bag. In another instance...
So Solomon, you said, sorry, that's a doctor's bicycle?
Yeah, you don't own it. You don't own that bicycle now. The government owns it. So it was a little difficult to try to get him to see it. Another case, we had a German farmer came in to me one day when I was in Hilversum, that's where our headquarters were. Mm-hmm. And he came into my office he could, most of the Dutch can speak reasonably good English, because mm-hmm. that's their second language. And he said he had four horses that the Germans had taken from him. Mm-hmm. And there was we had a remount area where we took all the horses that were not essential mm-hmm. to the Germans, because the Germans needed horses to get their troops out. Mm-hmm. So he had these in a great paddock, and he recognized his horses, and he wanted them. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, do you have the requisition that the Germans gave you for taking the horses? He said, yes, here it is, here. So he showed it to me. I said, they didn't requisition these horses. You sold them to them. And I says, they paid you for these horses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says, but they're my horses. I want them. I said, no, they're not your horses. I said, the Germans paid you for those horses. Those horses are now the property of the Dutch government. Mm-hmm. And I says, if you want those horses, you go down to The Hague and talk to the Minister of Agriculture down there, and if he wants you to have the horses, he'll let you have them. Mm-hmm. Oh, he was pretty annoyed at me.
Yeah. Though, of course, legally speaking, he had no right to be.
Oh, yeah, no, he had no right to them.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you deal at all with prisoners of war, or was that out of your jurisdiction?
No, that was not in my jurisdiction at all. The fighting troops looked after them. The only person we made a prisoner of, and John Buchan got a big kick out of it. I said to him, I said, John, the administrator under Seyss-Inquart, who was the, what do they call him, Gauleiter.
Yes, right.
Well, this fellow's name was von Schwebels, mm-hmm. and his headquarters was in The Hague. So I said, John, I said, here's something you can do. I said, I know you'll enjoy this. I said, go down and put von Schwebels in the bag. he says, with pleasure, Jack. He said, I'm on my way now. So he put von Schwebels under close arrest, and then we handed him over to the Dutch authorities.
And was he deemed a war criminal?
That, I don't know what became of him. The Dutch took him, and what they did with him, I don't know. Mm-hmm. We weren't interested. We had too many other things to do.
Well, on the same sort of vein, how about collaborators? How did the Dutch handle them, and how did that enter into your jurisdiction?
No, it didn't. The Dutch forces of the interior, as they're called, mm-hmm. that was the underground. They looked after them.
Were they as vicious with the collaborators as the French were with theirs?
I didn't see too much evidence of that. I saw some head-shaven women, but...
What did you think of that at the time?
What did I think of it?
You think it was justified?
It's funny, I never thought of it.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, this is what the Dutch are doing to their women who played fast and loose with the Germans, so mm-hmm. that's it. The collaborators were taken. There was a big camp at a prisoner of war camp at Voot, and most of them were incarcerated there. Mm-hmm. And when I left Holland in September to come back to Canada, they were still there mm-hmm. awaiting trial. And I don't think that wasn't the only place. I think there's a in Amersfoort, there was another big area. Down in the south, Sertogenbosch, mm-hmm. there was also another big collaborators' camp. And I don't know who fed them. I guess the British, they were fed British Army rations.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever find out what happened to them?
No. I've never followed it up. Mm. I think a number of them were given sentences, maybe a year or two or something like that. They served their sentence and then they returned as citizens of Holland.
Yeah. And I should think some of them would have been, at least this is purely supposition on my part, that were exiled, say, to the Dutch East Indies or something like that, because they were, again, turned over that area from the Japanese to the Dutch.
Yeah. That I don't know. I've never followed up on that. I must. There was a friend of mine I'm going to meet in London. He was with the Dutch underground. He was 17 years of age and he was a runner.
Mm-hmm.
And he was my contact. He'd come from
the German lines to you?
Yeah. from Van Beek and Laren. Mm-hmm. He'd come through the lines and let me know what was happening. So I'm going to meet him. I'll ask him when I see him in London this summer.
Mm-hmm. It just seems that a lot of personal, you know, retribution is taken out against these people. And in many cases, there were women who, perhaps with children, who were trying to support them.
Yeah.
And nowadays we can find reasons to justify what they did. But at the time, I suppose, with all the hatred that was let loose, that much was unleashed on these poor people.
Even today, when I was over there in 80, there were German tourists coming through. I was in Utrecht. And the chap I was with, he said, as soon as he heard Germans, these people speaking in German, he just revolted.
Really?
The hate is still there. They just don't like Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know whether that's majority of thought in Holland, but
certainly in the older set that actually experienced
it. It was with these, with this fellow Reynolds, Hugh Reynolds.
Tell me something. Was there a Dutch army in exile in Britain as the Poles had and as the French had? Because I know the Dutch were our allies right into about 1942 in the Pacific.
I don't know there's so much army, but there was Dutch navy, because we had quite a number of destroyers that worked along with the Allies, and there were some Dutch ships that took our troops in or supported our troops on D-Day. But as far as the Dutch army is concerned, the only ones that I saw was after the once we got into Holland, a lot of them were formed up, and they were turned out in Dutch, in the British battle dress, with the golden lion as the Dutch emblem.
Were these underground units that had been formed up into it?
Now that I can't tell you. I don't know if they made any definite formations, but as far as the officers were concerned, we had Baron Bootslar. He was a full colonel, and he was the sort of the senior liaison officer with 1st Canadian Corps. And then I had a captain, Carl, can't remember his last name now, and he was my liaison officer and my interpreter. If the Dutch couldn't speak, if there's some that couldn't speak English, but we didn't have much of a problem because, as I say, English was their second language. They learned it at school. And they're all reasonably good. You have quite good command of the Anglo-Saxon language.
Yeah. Were there orders given for the underground to disarm after the war? I have this image in my mind, and do correct me, because I'm sure it's wrong. Much like in Zimbabwe, you have these bands of unorganized, undisciplined guerrilla fighters with their arms, and that could create havoc in a post-war country. One that's trying to reform itself, especially with these guerrilla leaders who have got some taste of authority who don't want to relinquish it.
Now that I can't tell you. I know that I can't recall any or having heard of any orders that the underground was to be disarmed. I think what's happened is that they were absorbed into the Dutch army if they so chose, so that they were recruiting, for the Dutch army. When I was there, and I left in September, so...
It happened that soon, they started recruiting for their own army.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I suppose everything happened at a rapid pace after the war ended.
Yeah. But it was amazing how quickly the economy, the general economy, started to come back. Because, it wasn't a month, they wanted some coal. There was a distillery down in Delft. And they wanted to start making some gin. So they wanted coal. Well, we got them coal from Limburg. We just floated it down the Rhine in barges and tied it up beside their distillery. And in no time, they were... As a gift, they gave me a carboy of gin. And that's 22 liters.
A
great carboy like that. And they called their distillery the Allied Distillery.
But I suppose it was all, that it was an influx of Allied wealth, presumably from the British, or from the British and Americans.
I don't know where it came from. Yeah. They had to revalue their currency. And it was September the 22nd. And an order went out by the Dutch government that nobody could, that on the September the 22nd, the maximum a person could have was 5,000 guilders.
Really?
And they would issue, if they turned in 5,000 guilders of the old currency, they would issue them with 5,000 guilders of the new Dutch currency.
Mm-hmm.
And any more, any money that they had over and above the 5,000 guilders, they had to account for it.
Where they got it from?
Where they got it from. And there was a terrific black market going on prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And people were making money hand over fist. There was one chap, and I actually saw this, he had in his home he had a cupboard, a clothes cupboard, and it was just packed with the
old guilders?
The old guilders. And I said, how are you going to count for that? He says, I don't know, you want some? He offered me a little stacks of the old currency. And I could have taken it to our old field cashier and got the Allied government money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 100 guilders to the... No, it was 100 cents to the guilder. But I think it was a guilder for a dollar.
So it was 5,000 guilders?
Yeah.
Yeah? $5,000 for 5,000 guilders?
That's right.
Well, how did you like your experience doing this?
Well, I quite enjoyed it. It was, you know, it could be frustrating, but the team I had with me, those 25 officers,
mm-hmm.
they were all experienced in their own field. And all I did was just swan around and see how they were getting on, and if they had any problems, they could come in and discuss it with me, or I'd go around and see what they were doing.
Yeah.
So it was quite enjoyable, actually.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually the way an organization like that should run. You know, you're saddled with all the problems of every direction, nothing's going to be accomplished.
Well, of course, the main thing, the big thing, is to plan and to organize,
mm-hmm.
and then deputize.
Yeah.
And then just go around and supervise. And that's exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a fine time. Quite enjoyed it.
Did it give you the...
Because everything ran so well. I was... No headaches.
Well, did any other officers in your position in other countries, did they have as smooth a time as you, or?
I don't think the AGM and 2nd Canadian Corps had as easy a time as I had.
Where was he in Belgium?
Because he was in Germany.
Oh.
See, I was in Holland, and it was a...
You were a liberator.
Well,
it
was a piece of pie for me.
Yeah.
But he had his problems all right. And his name was he'd commanded the Royal Hamilton Light Infantry
before or after
before.
Mm-hmm.
He was an older man. He must have been about four. Oh, he was in his 40s, 45, 50.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, see, I was 36, 37.
Mm-hmm.
Hurley, his name was, H-U-R-L-E-Y.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was my opposite number at 2nd Canadian Corps, and we liaised. But his problems were, I had none compared, I had none, period.
Yeah, well, was he given a section of Germany as the Canadian sector that he...
Within 2nd Canadian Corps boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
He was responsible for that.
Well, one can just imagine the problems that would occur.
Yeah, of course, you see, no fraternization.
Looting.
Yeah, looting, curfew. He had curfews. We had no... Once the Dutch government took over, and they took over, as I say, quite early,
mm-hmm.
then they lifted the curfews and everything else, no problem.
Well, with the Dutch, if a Canadian soldier committed a crime, would that be your jurisdiction, or would that go straight to the military?
Straight to the military.
Okay.
He was a civilian crime.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was still treated under the KRNO. king's orders and regulations.
So if he raped a Dutch girl, he would be tried under...
court-martial, the Canadian Army court-martial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any problems with that?
We didn't have any, as far as I know, in Holland.
No cases of looting or of rape?
Not that I know of. But there were, in Italy, we had quite a few rape cases.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I just couldn't understand how the women in Sicily particularly, a 35-year-old woman,
mm-hmm.
she looks to be about 70,
mm-hmm.
according to our, you know, when we look at them.
Yeah. It ages incredibly, the climate and the
work. According to teeth, no dental care,
mm-hmm.
and not very clean. And, it was deplorable. There was a chap in the Royal Canadian Corps of Signals was charged with rape, and I attended this court martial just out of, you know, as the AAG, I felt I must see what's going on, so I went down and observed in this court martial. I just couldn't believe that he'd raped that woman.
Mm-hmm.
She was such a horrible looking thing.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently he didn't.
Didn't it? It would seem to me logical that in many cases a woman would be trying to milk the military out of money, food, what have you.
Yeah.
And rape would be a crime that would not be considered abnormal in that environment.
The Sicilians, that's their life anyway. Crime, you know, yeah. And there was looting went on too.
But to be expected, I should think, with Italy, more so than with the Dutch. Because they were an enemy part of the time through all of Sicily, and through the first part of the Italian campaign.
Right.
The Italians were the enemy.
All right. Yep.
No matter how warm the people could have greeted you, and they probably did.
Mm.
And no matter how well the Italian soldiers greeted you either, from what I've read, they're still the enemy.
That's right.
And if you're indoctrinated or propagandized enough to believe that the Italians are this way, you're going to not give them too much respect.
Well, I'd left Italy, I'd left Italy, but they did form an Italian brigade, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
and they came up and started to fight side by side with the Canadians in the latter part of the war in the Po Valley,
mm-hmm.
up around Lake... that big lake there, Como,
mm-hmm.
Lake Como.
I once read an interesting article about a battalion of Italians who were fascists,
mm-hmm.
and how this battalion actually faced the other Italians in combat.
It's probably would be in that area too.
Yeah.
Yeah, up around Milan,
mm-hmm.
in that area.
Quite bitter fighting too, from what I hear.
Was it?
The Germans didn't even trust these Italian fascists either. They kept them in the rear right
at
the end of the war.
Yeah. Yeah.
With good reason, too.
I would think so.
After the experience in the desert, the Italian soldier didn't really appear to be all that.
We had a Greek brigade attached to 1st Canadian Division,
mm-hmm.
the 3rd Mountain Brigade. And they fought for about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Just a breakout from around Rimini, going north along the coast. And they left in 6 weeks and left 800 dead.
Of their own?
Yes.
And there was no one to reinforce them, because that was it?
That was it. That was all.
Yeah.
They left 800 dead, over 800 dead, and they don't know how many wounded.
And I can just imagine that they fought savagely, gave no quarter
they
at all.
They gave the Germans no quarter. None whatsoever. They were absolutely fearless, you know.
Well, when you're fighting with the vengeance like that, you know, you're fighting for your entire country that
That's
is under
right.
the boot of the Germans.
Yeah, as far as I know, they took no prisoners alive.
Yeah. I also read in the history that there was a Malta brigade. Were these a Maltese, or was it simply a brigade that had been stationed in Malta?
Now, that I can't tell you. I know I saw a Jewish brigade.
Really?
Yes.
From what country? Palestine?
It must have been. They had the Star of David on their trucks.
Well, I think it must have been because Moshe Dayan, I think, served with them.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I know that there was a Jewish brigade fighting, I think, with the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when we were over, we did a swing over of the American side as a cover plan. And that's where I saw them. It was just in front of Florence. And there was a group of them. I don't know how many there were, but I recognized their trucks with the Star of David on it.
Mm-hmm.
A blue background with the white Star of David.
The Italian campaign sort of represents a United Nations effort almost, all the different brigades. Like, I think there was one from South America, Brazil, wasn't there?
There might have been. If there were, there was the Americans. We never saw them.
Yes.
The only ones we saw, we saw the Indians, East Indians.
How did you feel about the Indians, the way they fought?
Well, we took over and going into the Hitler line from the 8th Indian to his, I think it was the 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And they put up quite a good show.
There's been some criticism of the Indian soldier in the Second World War, that they didn't give it their all, they didn't send their best troops, etc. And yet, from what I've read, they put up a very valiant effort in the Italian campaign.
They certainly did. The advance to the Hitler line,
mm-hmm.
they did a very good job.
It really boils down to the quality of the officers leading them. Like, in the Singapore campaign in 1941-42, the British officers were not that good. I mean, they had been bled off, the good ones, and consequently the soldiers didn't fight well. But in Italy, they had good British officers leading them, so I think they fought a bit better.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the divisional commander. It was the 8th Indian Division.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis somebody. And when I was with 1st Division, we moved up and took over from them just north of the Sangro,
mm-hmm.
In around Lanciano and Ortona, and that Lanciano-Ortona road. This is the 8th Indian?
Yeah. There was the 4th and the 8th.
Yeah. And the 8th Indian Division had, Rajputans and Mahatras.
Mm-hmm.
There were two.
There were no Sikhs, I guess.
They were all Sikhs. Oh no, there were some others too, because some were Singh, and some were Din.
Mm-hmm.
Din was a different religion. I don't know which one it was. Because you can recognize them by. The Singh is a Sikh.
Is that an instrument they carry, or is it just...
Oh, it's a name.
Just a name.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the name Singh. No, that's right. They all have to have the surname. Is it surname Singh or Christian?
It's a Christian name, I think. Or it's a name that they...
They adopt.
They adopt.
Yeah.
And then the Din is the other one. They're Pakistanis, mostly.
It would have been a
whatever the religion is in Pakistan.
Hindu, isn't it?
Could that maybe that's what it is?
Yeah, Hindi. I think that's probably what it is.
Yeah. Hindi as opposed to the teachings of Vishnu.
Yeah. Yeah, from what I've read of the Indians and the different religions and the caste system, it was very difficult, the interworkings of a division and an army.
Right.
Because some were lower caste and
they
couldn't fight together or eat together
together. Yeah.
Interesting but strange.
Yeah.
Well, take me back to Canada then. You left in September, you say? Did you go by way of Britain?
When I left, I returned to Canada.
Direct?
To take a job,
mm-hmm.
With the Department of Veterans in Vancouver. I'd sat on a board in Appledorn for this job.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
This was back
in
the Netherlands?
This was in, probably July 45.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat for this board, and then a wire came through saying to release me and to return me to Canada because the Department of Veterans Affairs had a job for me in Vancouver.
A quick question. Did you meet your friend on the boat again going back?
No, I came back. I came back in the belly of a bomb bay of a Liberator bomber.
Did you?
15-hour flight from Prestwick to Dorval.
Straight to Montreal?
No, we put down at Goose Bay or Gander.
Mm-hmm.
And we refueled at Gander and flew on from Gander into Dorval.
Again, this was a priority move. You had to get there in a hurry.
Well, the Department of Veterans Affairs seemed to think so.
Yeah.
So I was back here on September the... Oh, I guess it was September the 1st. I mean, October the 1st.
1945.
Yeah.
Okay, sir, can I stop you right there? We're getting very near the end of the tape.
Fine, I'm coming into my story.